creamed over in West Salem.
Everyone ready? Gentlemen?
Really?
Didn't get a scratch.
Do you wear it?
Gentlemen?
Really?
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our House Committee on Transportation Policy this fine morning of February 8th, 2017. We have three bills that are up for hearings this morning, and after that we will hear from Mr. Campbell, an informational hearing on the Oregon Travel Information Council. So, Mr. Campbell, thank you for your patience in allowing us to move our bills first. This morning we have a number of people who have traveled from afar to address our committee, which is a pleasure. We don't always have a lot of guests here, so we're delighted that you're here this morning. What I'd like to do first is change the order that the bills are listed on the public hearing so that our folks who have come from afar can get on the road and get home. I'd like to first open our informational hearing on House Bill 2695. I'd like to invite first Director Burnett up. He is the Executive Director for the Board of Maritime Pilots. I think it would behoove us to set the stage since we have quite a few new people on our committee. He can give us a kind of a tell us about the Board of Maritime Pilots, sir, and what your charge is, and set the stage for this bill for us.
Thank you, Representative McEwen.
It's nice to have you here, Director.
I appreciate it, Representatives.
My name is Eric Burnett. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots. If I may, give me just a few seconds and let me fill everybody in a little bit on what the pilotage organizations do and the state's role in regulating them. There's a fundamental difference between a ship pilot and aircraft pilot, and it's basically this. Every time a 747 or 767 pilot goes to land on a runway, that runway is virtually like every other. It's the tower speaks English. The runway is painted the same. It's basically a similar environment, whether you're landing in Moscow or Madrid or anywhere else. A ship pilot is faced with a completely different set of circumstances. Every harbor is different. It is a unique instead of a common environment. For that reason, since time immemorial, when a ship comes into harbor, it will typically take on a pilot, a person who has local knowledge, skill, and expertise to bring the ship safely into the harbor. It's a very different definition of the term pilot, and it's certainly not the one that we're commonly familiar with. And we have three pilotage organizations in the state, three pilotage grounds. Those are Coos and Yaquina Bay, together as one ground, the Columbia River Bar, and the Columbia River itself, upriver from Astoria. The Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots, exist as a regulatory body under the Public Utility Commission. It seems like a little bit of an odd fit, except when you look at one of our three functions. Our three functions as a board are to assure safe and efficient pilotage, set training standards, and oversee licensing. So in that respect, we act somewhat like the Department of Motor Vehicles. And the third task that we have is to administer tariffs for all of our pilotage groups, thus the PUC umbrella that we work under. The Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots has been around since 1847. We predate statehood. We're a very small agency, 2 FTE. We license 65 pilots, give or take, depending on retirements and trainees. And those pilots are split, preponderance of them in the Columbia River, about in the 40s, typically 15, 16 on the bar, and at this point about two in Coos Bay. That shifts with time a little bit, but that's generally what we do. The bill that you have in front of you, if I may, came to us in April, or the issue came to us in April of 2015, and it was presented initially to the board as a fundamental disconnect. In one way, the issue as initially presented was that the same tug, tow, barge, and cargo, if coming from Port Angeles, Washington, required a pilot coming in, thus the pilotage fees. But if that same tug, tow, crew, barge, and cargo were coming from Port Alberni in BC, it did require a pilot. So, Coastwise voyage, no pilot. International voyage, pilot. All other things being identical.
I'm sorry, sir. Could you define coastwise for the committee?
Yes, I would be happy to. Coastwise is the maritime term for a domestic voyage. So it would be a trip from maritime voyage from California to Oregon or Washington to Oregon. And international voyage is anything else that originates in another nation. And it could be Canada, it could be Singapore, any of the above. That was a situation that was originally presented to us in April of 16. The question that was raised as a hypothetical to the board was whether this particular issue, this particular disconnect that I just mentioned, could be resolved through an administrative rule. We consulted with counsel and were told that we actually couldn't do it that way, that if we were to address this issue through the OARs, it would be in conflict with our statutes. And that is what, at this point, triggered the legislation that you have in front of you. My board is taking no stance on this. We do, however, stand by, ready to provide you with any additional information, any contacts, or any assistance whatsoever that we can provide. And of course, I would look forward to working with the board and supporting this committee going forward with any information that you would need on the maritime trade above and beyond.
Great, thank you. A very long storied history, as you can tell, with this organization, and it's been critical to the economy of this state for, what, over 100 and how many years?
Since 1847.
170 or 80 years.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
We appreciate your work, sir. Okay. Any questions for Director Burnett? Yes, Representative
Thank
Witt.
You, Madam Chair. You mentioned international vessels. I'm assuming that would be the international part of that is from the origin would be outside of the United States. Is that a function of the Jones Act by chance? Do you know?
That's an excellent question. The Jones Act would play into it. The Jones Act, for those of you who aren't aware, is the federal legislation that originated in the 1920s, I believe, that basically says a U.S. flag vessel must be U.S. built, U.S. crewed, U.S. owned, U.S. manned. And it is if you see a U.S. flag vessel, you are in virtually all cases looking at something that is subject to Jones Act. In this particular case, my understanding is that Jones Act is addressed in this legislation. But if I may, Representative Witt, what I'd like to do is defer that to the sponsors of the legislation, the advocates for the legislation, and those who might oppose it to discuss that particular issue.
Further questions, Madam Chair?
Just follow up.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you a question that I don't necessarily presume that you would know the answer to. You may not be, probably aren't, a lawyer in international law. But if commerce between nations has been regulated, I presume that authority rests with the federal government.
I think you're correct in that it does, and pilotage is something that has been dealt with at a federal level since before the Constitution.
And if that is in fact the case, and I'd be interested with anyone else who's going to be testifying subsequently, are you aware or any subsequent witnesses, if they're aware, could inform me of this? Would there be any provision in the Jones Act or any other regulation that governs the situation that you've addressed in your testimony provide for state regulation of interstate commerce?
I'm not aware of any provisions in the Jones Act that do or don't apply to that. We do, as a board, though, license pilots in parallel with the U.S. Coast Guard. So every Oregon pilot is licensed by our state and also is required to have a federal license as well. Am I getting at your question?
Yes, you are.
Okay.
Madam Chair, follow up. I'm concerned that there's an issue here potentially of first federal preemption and secondly our state's inability as a state to regulate interstate commerce.
If I may, I'm not prepared on that question.
Yeah, I understand.
And I would be happy to follow up with you on that. I think in this particular instance, I think it is germane to this bill. And if I could ask you to, as well, if you would to direct that to some of the folks who will be testifying.
Madam Chair, I can't help but think that that issue may be central here, and if we could get an opinion from legislative counsel, I think it would be important to understand that.
And we can pursue that, sir. There may be other folks on the subsequent
yes.
panel that may be able to
yes.
address that issue. I'm not quite sure about that.
Thank
but
you.
If not, this is just a first hearing, so we will have opportunities to do that if need be.
Thank you.
Thank you. Director Burnett, you've completed your testimony.
Yes, okay. I have.
Thank you so much for being here.
Okay, thank you. My pleasure.
Senator Roblin, would you like to join us this morning? We appreciate you being here.
Good to see you again.
Good morning.
Good morning. And for the record, Senator Arne Roblin, Senate District 5, I think that's a really good catch, and I think we need to look at the Jones Act, though I believe that what we're asking to do here, Washington has already done. So I believe that issue was taken care of. But I think legal counsel and others will be a good question to ask with respect to the Jones Act. Not something I had thought about when we were drafting.
Thank you, Senator.
This, because Coos Bay and Newport are the other pilots, Jerry, besides the Columbia, that is regulated. It has been an ongoing issue in our community since we became a city, piling coming across the bar. And I will tell you that on different occasions, the bar is not the best place you want to be in Coos Bay, though it's much simpler than the Columbia bar. And there's some other bars up and down the coast that are a lot harder. I think when our jetty used to go out farther and all that kind of stuff, it might have even been safer. But that's another issue we'll have to take up with the Corps of Engineers and others who are supposed to maintain those places. This came to our attention, and in fact, mostly with Chair McEwen and a local mill. One of the issues that we have had ongoing for a while is we don't have as much material to put through our mills as we used to. We are not harvesting in ways that we have done for so in the past. And so finding material became an issue, and one of our mills decided they would look at British Columbia and see if we could get some logs from there. And they started barging those materials because barging is a very efficient way to move material up and down the coast. We have crews, many from Coos Bay, who do that trade. They also go and take materials from the United States mainland to Hawaii. And so we had not realized there was a problem because they've been doing this safely for a long time, and we recognize that bar crossings and bar pilots are exceedingly important for safety on our coastline. And we have had those places where things happened before they got in the bar. The new Carissa got to spend some time on our beach, and I think if they'd had a bar pilot on there, they would have gotten themselves out farther. A lot of things could have happened differently, but it wasn't to the point where they were going to put the bar pilot on, and it was in weather that you aren't going to transfer bar pilots. So when you look at that, we feel very strongly as a community that bases a lot of its industry on maritime that you have to have people who know how to safely get through the bar and get stuff delivered. This particular one was a surprise because we'd never had bar pilots on our barges before, and I assume in large part because most of the stuff coming in on barges originated from another port on the coast, and it was Coos Bay to Los Angeles or Los Angeles to wherever, and it was in the U.S. And when this started happening, this came up, we thought the best solution would be to see if a rule could be done because we'd seen other places doing some of this, like Washington State, and went through that process, had great meetings. I think people looked at it, and I think the attorneys decided, no, we have to have a bill. So that brings you this bill today. That says that those crews that are bringing us down can continue to do what we have done forever with respect to safety and getting materials there. I do not know personally whether we've had crews that were not American crews on American tugs coming in and out. There's people out here that could answer that question. So from my perspective, and almost all of them stop in a port in Washington before they come on down to Coos Bay. I believe it's the right thing to do. We've tried to go through the process that we can to make it an efficient process, and look forward to any questions. I don't have a lot of the answers, but I know there's people here in the audience that do have those answers. So thank you for the opportunity, and thanks for hearing this bill, because I think it is important for the economy of our region.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the senator? All right. Carry
thank
on
you
with your
much.
Day, sir.
Yeah.
All right.
Off to Ways and Means, we'll figure out.
There it is. Next, I would like to call Greg Peden, Jason Smith, and Mr. Bartz, please. Welcome to our committee, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning. And in any order you choose, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Greg Peden. I'm here on behalf of Southport Lumber Company this morning. With me are Dave Bartz from the Schwabe, Williamson & Wyatt Law Firm and Jason Smith from Southport Lumber. Just a brief introduction, and I'm going to let Jason do the testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chairperson, representatives. My name is Jason Smith. I'm the operations manager of Southport Forest Products, Coos Bay, Oregon. Just give you a real quick brief history of Southport Forest Products. Southport Forest Products was founded by myself and my current business partner about 20 years ago. We saw an opportunity to build a small log sawmill in Coos Bay and convert what was then unutilized small pulp logs into lumber, and we've taken that and we've grown our business substantially from when we started out with about 20 employees. Currently we have about 125 employees in Coos County working for us directly, as well as a substantial number of employees employed in logging and trucking and other types of jobs associated with our business. A little history on our need to utilize barging in and out of Coos Bay. We started barging logs into Coos Bay in 2000, so this was quite a long time ago. We knew that there was not enough available material locally in Coos Bay to supply our needs, so we started expanding our sourcing areas. British Columbia at that time made a lot of sense, and we started buying logs in British Columbia. We were engaged in that business for a number of years, not only ourselves, but a number of other mills in southern Oregon. Up until about 2007, we stayed engaged in that business because of currency exchange rates and an economic downturn that took place, and we stopped importing logs out of Canada around 2007. Starting in about 2012, Southport built a barge slip at our mill where we could bring logs directly into our mill, as well as export wood chips right out of our mill via barge to pulp and paper companies on the Columbia River. Since then, we've been very actively engaged in barging chips from our mill to several pulp mills on the Columbia River. It's a very important part of our business. Starting in 2012 again, we started importing logs out of Canada because of exchange rates and other issues. It became viable for us to start bringing logs in out of Canada again. This practice took place until about a year ago, when we were informed that we would have to start hiring a Coos Bay bar pilot to bring these barges into Coos Bay. Traditionally, we never had to do that. And for us, the economic impact is about $7,500 every time we bring a barge in. And so what we're asking is the committee consider this legislation that will help streamline this and take that requirement away from us. One of the things that we see is the same tugboat captains that drive the chip barges from Southport to pulp mills on the Columbia River and are navigating the bar are not required to have a pilot, but as soon as we bring cargo in from Canada, we're required to have a pilot. So that's where we talk about the domestic versus international voyages. We thought we had a solution, and the board gave us an opportunity of clearing customs with barges coming out of Canada in Washington before we come to Coos Bay, and then we don't need to have a pilot the problem is sometimes the logistics can be quite challenging. If there's weather issues and expense having to go into these ports in Washington to clear customs, depending on where we load in Canada, can be quite challenging and can be very expensive as well. So thank you for consideration and answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Mr. Bartz?
I wasn't prepared to have testimony this morning, but given Representative Witt's questions, I'd be glad to address a couple of those if the committee would like.
Representative Witt, would
Please.
That be helpful? Yes, sir.
Very briefly, the preemption first is an issue.
I'll need to have you identify yourself for the record.
David Bartz, Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt for Southport in this bill. Thank you for your questions, Representative Witt. Preemption first is a question of, has the federal government occupied an area and that somehow the state's trying to interfere with? And the feds have always allowed the states to regulate pilotage to some degree. So that's just one piece. The Jones Act is essentially there to define what is a U.S. ship, because then there's all kinds of benefits that flow from being a U.S. ship. Those issues aren't the U.S. the ship and the flagging and the Jones Act aren't implicated by this at all. So we don't think there's a problem. It's a great question. We'll go back and double check to make sure. But what we're really thinking is and believe is that Washington has an exception that's codified that says this kind of cargo doesn't need to have state pilotage. Oregon's allowed non-state pilots or just U.S. Coast Guard regulated pilots for a very long time. All we're trying to do is bring to light and codify what's been occurring with everybody's agreement for a very long time. So I don't think there's any implications of those important pieces of legislation, but we will confirm that for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I?
Yes, Paul.
Jason's testimony was that ships originating from, in this instance, I think Canada.
Representative, what I want to be clarifying, ships are very different than tugs and barges.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
The vessel in question here is required to have a bar pilot having originated from Canada. On what authority is that requirement to have that bar pilot?
I'm now making the case for the other side, if you will. Currently, it's not required, and for a long time it wasn't. We only had about a 16-month period when the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots said they had to have a pilot, and they've now rescinded that. So today, just to make it clear, those aren't required. The reason for the bill is to make sure that we don't get flip-flopped again and whipsawed again. So today, it's not required, and prior to that 16-month blip, it wasn't required. And then there was an issue as to whether it needed to be required or not. And the Oregon Board, which required it, then backed away and said they can't require it. So that's why we're here to just confirm for everybody it's not required. That wasn't quite your question, but that's why we're here, to reset that piece. The foreign nature of it is just where the cargo comes from, not the vessel itself or the crews. The crews are U.S.-licensed, U.S. Coast Guard-licensed mariners.
That answer answers the question, actually, that I had. So thank you very much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Wilson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. We don't get too much barge traffic down on the Rogue River in Josephine County, and I'm really...
A navigable waterway, however.
Yeah, right. I wanted to ask you what these actually look like. Are these barges self-propelled, or are they towed by a tug, or what's the deal?
Gentlemen, it would be helpful that we don't enlighten us as to what this maritime industry looks like.
Sure, please. I'll give you a background. A typical log barge that we bring in from British Columbia is about 400 feet in length and 100 feet in width. It'll carry approximately 500 truckloads of logs on it. And it is towed with a tugboat that is about 150 feet long, more or less. On our chip barges, they're slightly smaller. They're 250 to 300 feet long and 80 feet wide, and they might haul somewhere between 5 and 7,000 tons of wood chips on them.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you.
I was going to pull up the bill. I think, Mr. Bartz, it might be helpful to the committee why the definition of the size of the vessels is important in the bill. Could you explain that, please?
Yes, the bill just says that U.S. flag towing vessels, so again, this gets back to their U.S. vessels that are towed on 10,000 tons or less. So they're trying to limit this to this trade. It's very specific. It's a very limited application that we're trying to make clear. It's wood. It's products from British Columbia. That's clear in the bill. And it's in this limited nature, this small, relatively small nature. I know they sound large, but in the maritime business, these are the kind of usual or customary size of barges that move a lot of cargo. And that's the nature. That's the reason for the weight requirements. It's a measurement that's standard in maritime issues, is how you measure the size of a ship, is the tonnage that's in the bill.
So you have a barge and you have a tug, and the tug captains are licensed. So I think that is part of the issue here.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Vial.
This is, I'm sure, horribly naive, but I'm just wondering what the term domestic has, what relevance that has when it says under 200 gross tons domestic.
Again, that relates to the measurement. So it's defining the 200. It's defining the 10,000 gross tons as a domestic measure. There are international measures.
Thanks.
You can measure tons different ways.
Got it.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a very basic question. It's a hypothetical. Imagine a world where British Columbia was actually a state, not in a different country. They would be able to do what California and other states currently do. We wouldn't be here talking about a different issue, right? Because the current law says that if it's coming from other states, it's fine?
That's correct.
Okay. So second question is, at least under the spirit of NAFTA, where we're all one big happy trading family, theoretically, BC isn't a state, but in a lot of ways it kind of is. So my point is, it seems reasonable that if it just happens to be north instead of south, but they're bringing products in and it seems to be working, this bill makes a lot of sense to me. If I'm understanding, we're not really changing anything, we're just treating it like a state in a lot of ways.
For purposes of this trade that has already been ongoing and benefits both sides, yes.
Thank you. Perfect.
I think one of the questions I would raise, just for the benefit of the committee, is the fact that this has been done for quite some time, decades, if not centuries, maybe more. And nothing changed until very recently. Nothing in the situation changed. No safety issues changed. It was just a rule that came forward that now the Board of Maritime Pilots has rescinded, correct? So this is just codifying in statute the way things have been done and hopefully will be done in the future. Am I
correct?
Mr. Smith, am I getting that correct?
Yes, you
okay.
are. Yes,
all right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Witt.
Madam Chair, I am in no way even close to being an expert.
And, sir, this is an incredibly complicated issue for such a small
in international trade, but I do know that it is common for us, for states, to be able to set standards within their state borders. However, I think the manner in which international trade is conveyed may have crossed a border here. Bad pun. May have crossed the line where this could potentially be a matter that needs to be taken before Congress and not the Oregon House of Representatives. I am just unsure, and I think that it's fundamentally important to have that issue answered.
And we certainly can request that council bring us an opinion. Mr. Bartz, do you have any comment? How should we be pursuing this with legislative council to make sure we're on the right track here?
Well, again, on behalf of Southport and other businesses that need this service, I would tell you that I don't think the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots belongs in the business of requiring pilots where none are required, where the Coast Guard says the mariners are adequately, safely trained and licensed. Everything's good. So I appreciate the effort. I just don't see here, this is a state that has long had some opportunity to regulate pilotage. And all we're doing is acknowledging with the state that we're only going to go so far, that state pilots will be here and federally licensed pilots will have an opportunity to do other things. It's not so much the trade which is at issue, it's the pilotage. And we're trying to limit the state's authority of the pilotage.
Yeah, but sure. We certainly can pursue this, Representative Witt.
I would not in any way deny the fact that this is an issue that seems to beg for resolution. And I have a great deal of sympathy that this issue be resolved. I remain unconvinced that we are the appropriate place to bring that resolution about.
Okay. This is our first hearing. We have other questions that we certainly can answer along the way. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a clarification. You brought up this. My understanding is that currently for the federal government requires licensed pilot, U.S. Coast Guard certified pilot. We're just talking about where the state requires a pilot for something coming from outside the United States?
Yes, Mr. Representative, that's correct.
Other questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Safe travels back.
Thank you.
Will be posting another hearing and work session on this at some time in the future, so we'll let you know when that occurs.
Thank you.
Watch OLIS.
Thank you.
All right. I would also like to invite up next, we're honored to have with us, Captain Rick Gill from the Columbia River Pilots. Captain Gill, thank you so much for coming down today. And just know what great respect we have for the work that you do. I have had the privilege of riding out with Coos Bay Towboat out onto a vessel and climbing up the side and watching Captain Yates do his work. It's a daunting task that you take on every single day, and it's dangerous, and you are very skilled at what you do, and we really, truly appreciate your service. So
well, thank you.
I want to acknowledge
very much.
That.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Captain Rick Gill. I'm the president of the Columbia River Pilots, and I'm here to testify in opposition of House Bill 2695. My organization has already submitted a written testimony, and I'd rather just like to elaborate on some other points today, and then obviously answer any questions if you have any afterwards. As you know, House Bill 2695 would change Oregon pilotage law to exempt certain tugs towing barges on foreign voyages from well-established state pilotage requirements. Please keep in mind that as far as pilotage is concerned, Oregon is the only entity that regulates pilotage when a vessel is on a foreign voyage. The U.S. Coast Guard does not regulate pilotage in these circumstances. The language in the bill is unclear and seems inconsistent with standard U.S. maritime regulatory language. The bill is seeking to regulate foreign voyages, but the words coasting, trade, and coastwise are defined under U.S. law as voyages between two U.S. ports. This bill is unclear as to whether a person must even hold a federal pilotage or act as federal pilot endorsement. A federal mariner license required for the towing vessel when operating under a coastwise endorsement applies only qualifications for a particular size and class of vessel. This seems to suggest that even minimal federal pilotage standards would not apply. And again, a coastwise endorsement is defined as a voyage between two U.S. ports. As far as state pilots, they must meet rigorous training requirements to obtain a license, acquire years of experience on a particular pilotage ground, and have continuing professional development obligations. The Columbia Willamette pilotage grounds is over 85 nautical miles. That's a lot of territory. Requiring a state pilot means that a tug operator has guidance from an expert with current and detailed local knowledge, which promotes public safety and protection to the environment. All stakeholders should have the opportunity to comment, including the U.S. Coast Guard and the state of Washington. Given these stakes, the committee should resist efforts to rush this bill simply to meet the economic interests of a few stakeholders. And thank you again for letting me speak.
Yes, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Out of curiosity, is this reciprocal of Canada? I mean, does Canada then require some of these same things, like their own pilot or their own licensed pilot, to come into their ports?
I don't know how Canada does it,
okay,
to be honest with you, without looking into it.
Representative McLean.
Sir, from your comments, if you're talking about fishing vessels and you're talking about some other items, so the former speakers indicated they thought it was a very limited, you know, type of barge or, you know, type of vessel. And so you're acting as if it takes in much more than that. Is that a true statement or
a
summary?
I guess it would be one piece, ma'am, of the piloting's grounds. They're targeting, I should say. I wouldn't undermine the size of a ship to a barge. Mm-hmm. I mean, as stated earlier, a barge might be 400 feet, tugs 150, plus maybe a couple hundred foot of tow line. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're up to a 750 foot, basically. Mm-hmm. And not only does it, and it's not in line, when you have a barge behind a tow, it actually, as you turn, it actually moves side to side, which is even more dangerous than actually a ship can be, having a barge swing in front of an outbound vessel or stuff like that. So it's very important to, you know.
Madam Chair.
Follow up?
So, yes, ma'am.
My follow-up question would just be, the mm-hmm. comments that you made really talk to the idea of why you would want a local, you know, pilot or someone local who understood that particular part of the water. So is that your major issue?
Yes. It would be that would be for the safety to have a state license, and the new or the proposed legislation doesn't even seem to address having a first class federal pilot even on board, which is less qualifications as a state pilot, but still more than just a licensed mariner.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Any questions, Representative Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rick, you. You referenced a code that provides for the regulation of domestic to domestic port. Could you provide us with that code?
Yeah.
I think that may be getting to the heart of the issue, frankly.
Okay. Yeah, we can get that back to the committee that works for you. Thank you.
Vice Chair Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just related to some of the, so from the testimonial letter, it mm-hmm. says that 2695 would relax some of the requirements that a pilot would undergo, including potential alcohol levels or any of those type of not drinking for 12 hours prior to, you know, going over this bar or this navigable water. Can you elaborate on that?
There's some of that may be the standards that a state pilot works under, and the qualifications that maybe a federal pilot has to work under. When they're under a federal, when they're under the U.S. Coast Guard, those are the qualifications or the standards they have to go through in the letter. Whereas the state pilot, it's zero compared to the federal being 0.04. Sort of.
So this bill would allow them to operate under federal guidelines instead of our state guidelines.
Correct. My understanding.
Mr. Burnett, we may need you back up here. I have a couple of questions. It may be helpful to have you here. Captain Gill, I guess one of the things I'd be interested in hearing from you is, and you may not be able to answer, and Mr. Burnett, I don't know if you can either, because we may need to have someone come in and talk to us about the licensure of our tug captains. I want to make sure that we clearly understand that our tug captains are also very well trained and licensed, and that they bring barges across and have been doing it for quite some time, decades as well. I guess my question to you is, you know, to Mr. Smith's point, what changed that would require a pilot now when a pilot has not been required for decades in the barge traffic arena? Why do we need a pilot now when we haven't needed a pilot on a barge tug prior? except for this one little window where it was applicable. And then the Board of Maritime Pilots rescinded that requirement. Why do we need one now when we haven't needed one for decades?
Yeah, I don't know of that window or what's been going on. Just kind of my understanding of the law, I guess. If it comes from Vancouver, B.C., it's a foreign voyage. It comes into a U.S. port. It has to have a state pilot. If it comes from, my understanding, if it comes from, Washington into Oregon, my understanding was it still had to have a federal pilot on board.
So I just want to make sure we're all clear on the scenario. So for the past many, many decades, a vessel could come into Coos Bay, pass customs in Coos Bay, correct? There's an issue of about passing customs here that I don't think we've asked. And maybe we need to clarify what changed in the last couple of years as to where that bar, that tug, can pass customs with that load. And what happens with the pilotage issue regarding where that customs can be done. Because it's my understanding that barges of logs for quite some time came into Coos Bay and passed customs in Coos Bay. Is that correct?
I can't speak. I don't know. Not on Coos
I think
Bay,
that's
ma'am.
Part of the issue here we're trying to resolve.
Yeah.
Is the technicality of the barges used to come from Canada, pass customs, come into Coos Bay, did not require a pilot.
Okay.
The safety issue has not changed. The bar has not changed. The certification of these very well-trained tug captains has not changed the way I understand it. So I'm trying to figure out why it's different now compared to 2000 when Mr. Smith started bringing barges of logs in, as did other folks. And this doesn't just impact Mr. Smith. It impacts other mill owners as well. So this is a broader scope than probably we understand today.
Correct. And mm-hmm. and all other pilotage groups also.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's why I'm here.
Understood.
My understanding was when they left, a lot of times they'd leave Canada, and they would go into a Washington port, clear customs, and then they would come into Coos Bay, therefore not needing a state licensed pilot mm-hmm. because it's not a foreign voyage.
Which has a great deal of expense.
Correct.
Granted.
Yep.
Yeah.
But in...
So where they pass customs in the big scheme of things, how does that factor into this issue that we're dealing with right now?
The customs part, I don't have any comment on that.
Mr. Burnett?
Madam Chair, if I can refer back, if you'll allow me to discuss something that I have heard talk of anecdotally but would be worthy of future inquiry perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that the procedures for clearing customs itself may have changed, in that it may have been possible in the past to simply, for a tug and tow combination, tug and barge combination, to come in fairly close to a customs port, do the clearance offshore without coming in, and then proceed on a coastwise voyage from there. That may no longer be possible, and that may have been the genesis of this particular issue. Again, this is anecdotal, and I would want to have a chance to look into that to verify it.
Okay,
but has been a factor here, I believe.
I think that's something that we may want a little more information about. Yes, Mr.
Actually,
Barreto.
Actually, Representative Witt was first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rick, I'm trying to get to what body, whether it's the federal government or not, that regulates this type of commerce. And you made the statement or something to the effect that there's a requirement to pass U.S. Customs, and there's presumably a difference in the way that commerce is handled, whether it originates domestically or it originates internationally. Who determines that? Is that the federal government or the state of Oregon?
That I don't know. who determines that?
Uh-huh. Is that written in U.S. code? Do you know?
I do not know.
Could you find that out for us, possibly?
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You had referred to, at the beginning, you talked about pilots, international jet pilots, and then maritime pilots. And so when a jet takes off from here and lands in another country, they don't have a pilot from that country going in there. So I'm just wondering about when there's trade, like the chair said, you know, going back and forth all the time, coming in and always has been, why other countries like Canada aren't just licensed to come in here and pass the same tests that the pilots here would pass in order to qualify?
The answer is that in looking at Captain Gill and the other pilots, the other 65 pilots that we license, every single one of them has a lifetime, literally a lifetime of experience. It's a career that people come to in at the late midpoint in their career. So, for instance, a lot of the river pilots come out of the tug and barge industry on the Columbia River and come in with several decades of experience. And for somebody to amass that kind of experience in the international trade, there just isn't the opportunity to do that. Is that answering your question?
It answers the question from your perspective, but it doesn't really answer the question from are they qualified. I mean, he had to start at some point. You know, he didn't have a lifetime of experience when he first started. You have to start sometime, and you develop as you go. If these barges are coming down all the time from Canada, they're going to accrue experience just coming down into these ports. If there's other trade coming in here, they're going to do the same thing. If we go from here up to Canada, it seems like they would accrue the same kind of experience. And so if there's trade going back and forth, then it would seem to me like this is an added cost and encumbrance, you know, for that trade to take place efficiently.
It is a burden. It is a burden on the industry, certainly. Our job as a board is to define where that licensure requirement, where the pilotage requirement starts, what class of vessel, you know, basically what the tonnages are, what the trade is. Do we want to have different requirements for oil versus logs, for instance? But yes, it is. It's a burden, and it's aimed at a safety focus for us as a board.
Representative Barreto, to follow up on that, Mr. Burnett, I think one piece that's missing here, and I may defer to others in the audience who have testified prior, one of the things that's missing here is the rigorous qualification that those tug captains go through. These aren't fly-by-night guys. These are guys who are licensed to move tugs. They have also years and years and years of experience and high-level certifications to be able to captain a vessel, a towboat or a tug that moves a barge. And we haven't had an opportunity to hear anything about, I think, the level of rigor and certification that they are required to have to come in and out of our ports as well. And so I hearken back to the question, is what changed? They have been moving barges through our waters for decades, and all of a sudden something changed. Why did it change? And that's what the question I want to keep getting back to. If something fundamental changed, we should know that. And if it's a safety issue, we should know that. Otherwise, as has been indicated, the Board of Maritime Pilots has indicated it's not required. You brought it on for a little bit and then stepped back. So this codifies in statute what the practice has been. To Representative Witt's question, I think we need a legislative opinion on that. We will certainly pursue that. If there are any other areas of expertise that you all as a committee would like me to bring forward for our next hearing, we would be happy to. But yes, Representative Vile and then Representative McLean.
I just wanted to make the observation that your analogy to airline pilots when you first began to speak a little while ago left me a little cold, in all honesty. I'm a commercial pilot myself, and I can tell you that approaching a mountainous dirt strip is nothing like landing at PDX. And we have to have the training for all sorts of situations, which I think goes to the chair's observations about perhaps these tug pilots. I wanted to ask one question, though, Madam Chair. I thought I heard Mr. Smith say that the cost to put a pilot on these barges pulled by tug was $7,500 per trip. Did I hear that correctly?
Sir, I'm not sure on that, especially for
We can invite the other panel back up when
okay.
we're done.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Mine was just a simple question. I came in late, and I apologize for that. But I agree with Representative Witt that there's a federal, layer of issues that we need to look at as far as the term. I agree that, we care about safety. The third one that I didn't hear anybody talk about was the difference between Washington and Oregon. Why? We're talking about the same coastline, and so why, do you stop in Washington and it's okay, and then we have an issue in Oregon and it's not okay? So, we're talking about the same coastline. So I didn't hear anybody talk about that. So if there's more information.
Representative McLean, we need to bring some clarification to that, unless someone will bring the other panel up and see if someone can answer that.
It's not fine. Sure. Next time, whatever.
But. We will seek that information for you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remain unconvinced to this point that we have either the legal or constitutional authority to regulate that. But if legislative counsel tells us we do, then I, too, am very concerned about what has changed. And I think we all need in this committee an answer to that question, should we have the authority to regulate? And I'm one possible scenario, and it's purely speculative, but has there ever been a history of a federal regulation that there has to be a pilot and someone has overlooked that for decades, if not a century, and all of a sudden folks become aware of it and think that maybe we ought to adhere to that? Is that a potential scenario?
Well, sir, I think it could be. I don't know. I don't know how long it's been going on, and why it's changed. But if the law is from a foreign country to the U.S., you need a state pilot. There should have been a state pilot. Yeah. That would be my understanding.
Okay.
So maybe it's been. I'm getting too far in for today as far as research and stuff.
I understand.
We'll all be back.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I agree that that's a critically important.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Any more questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You, too, understand the pilot culture certainly more than I do. My question would be, when the pilot is transferred out to the tug as it begins to cross the bar, or it stands off the bar waiting for the pilot to get there, what do you think the reaction will be of the tug pilot as he stands aside the helm and surrenders it to the pilot? What's your conjecture on how that would look? Would they say, what are you doing here? Obviously, they probably professionally have some attitude about surrendering the helm at Coos Bay to someone who's supposedly more professional than they.
Yes, sir. I have not seen that. It's common practice in a piloting ground. You're going to have a state licensed pilot in whatever state you're in the country is going to get on and not necessarily take control as far as actually grabbing levers, but that's up to the between the pilot and the captain. But the pilot will be there. Whereas, like when we get on a ship, we don't grab the wheel and start steering the ship. We give orders of the speed and the direction. And it's the same with a tugboat. Most of the time in the Columbia River, it's easier for us just to sit in the seat and steer the tug in tow.
but not all the time. Quite a few times, I stay and do the same piloting as I do a ship, and let the mate or the captain on the ship, you know, steer the tow and give them courses and speeds and stuff, just like I would a ship. So that's kind of a master pilot exchange at the very beginning of all that stuff, how the trip's going to go and how, you know, who's going to do what type of information. But I don't know if there's a big ego or a battle there between them all. It's just finally, you know, if the law requires a pilot, everybody knows that, you know, so I haven't seen it.
But just to be clear, that has not been common practice, except the last couple of years in bringing barge and tug across. Mm-hmm. So I can't certainly answer your question, but it has not been the common practice.
Okay.
Captain Gill, this may be an opportunity for you at some point to invite members of the committee to come and observe the work that you do. It is fascinating, amazing, and wonderful. So if any of you have an opportunity to go watch one of our bar pilots at work, please accept the invitation.
Yeah, you're all welcome.
Yeah. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Would any of you like me to bring the prior panel up? Do you have further questions now that have been generated? All right. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. I will close the hearing on House Bill 2695 and open a hearing on House Bill 2022. I'm going to leave right now. I'm going to have to excuse myself briefly. I'm going to turn the gavel over to my very capable vice chair, Vice Chair Weil, and I believe I would like to make an announcement briefly that we are going to hold House Bill 2289 over. I think there is some amending that needs to be done, so we will finish with House Bill 2022 today, and then Mr. Campbell go into the informational hearing. All right.
All right, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2022, and we got a report, Mr. Walker.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2022 excludes volumetric mixers from the definition of fixed load vehicle. Some of the other vehicles that are considered truck-mounted transit mixers, a cement truck, this is very similar in that it is mixing to order on site. You know, some other exemptions for are travel trailers, self-propelled mobile cranes, and tow vehicles.
Thank you very much. All right, we've got Representative Evans is here, and since I know we're all really busy today, why don't we take Representative Evans first?
Representative Nierman also.
And, I see Representative Nierman also. Thank you. You know the drill, please.
So thank you, Chair Weil and Vice Chair Meek and members of the committee. I'm going to just be brief here because I'm going to turn this over to people who know this better than I do. But this is a good business bill.
Can you just identify yourself for the record, please? Thank you.
I'm State Representative Mike Nierman from House District 23. This is a good bill. It's a good way to support businesses. A good way to support jobs in Oregon, and I'll turn over to Representative Evans and then other experts.
Representative Evans.
Vice Chair Weil, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I, too, will be very brief.
Just identify yourself for the record,
yes,
please.
My name is Paul Evans. I represent House District 20, including Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, South Salem, if not the prettiest, one of the prettiest districts in the state of Oregon. The goal today really is to present a bill to you that is truly one of those simple fixes. It does good things. It helps small business. It promotes fairness. And it will provide certainty. And in this particular environment where we're hopefully going to have a transportation package and we're hopefully going to start getting back to rebuilding infrastructure and we're hopefully going to put people back to work, simplicity, certainty, and fairness are important. And I'm just very grateful to be a part of this particular bill. I learned a lot about concrete trucks. I also learned that in a weird way, we are currently disincentivizing an environmentally friendly truck at the expense of the one that's not environmentally friendly. So if the fairness and the small business part don't get you, the environmental piece of this should get you, because ultimately the trucks we're talking about bringing into alignment here are the trucks that don't waste concrete and don't actually put extra gases in the environment when they have to drop their materials and depart. So it's actually a good bill for everybody. Look forward to seeing this hopefully move forward. And if you don't have any questions, I will give it to the people that know what they're talking about.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions for the representatives? Representative Beretta.
Yeah. A volumetric mixer, can you define that?
Vice Chair Vial, Representative Beretta, I cannot do a good job, but there's actually really cool pictures, and the smart people will be able to do that.
So there's another panel coming up.
Yes, we have more.
All right, thank you.
Specialists to testify. Any other questions of our colleagues?
Just a quick comment. I appreciate Representative Evans acquiescing the most beautiful district in House District 24. So
we can share.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you taking the time to come. Let's go then. When am I going to Rich Angstrom? And who else do you want to have come up with you?
We have, I think, four people to testify. And if you want to bring them up as a panel all together on the next one, would be
all right.
The next panel would be good. And I'll get through the technical stuff. So, good morning. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. Thank you for the committee and the chair for and the vice chair for taking this matter up. I'd also like to thank Representative Nierman and Representative Evans for working with a group of some of our smallest companies in our industry as they tried to find a fair approach that kind of equalizes the playing field with the bigger construction, concrete companies. And we fashioned this bill in a way that we think promotes fairness. And I'm not technologically, I was kind of joking. It's fun kind of being calling myself old school now, because as soon as I see a computer, I worry about pushing the wrong button. What I want to start with is the issue is around what we call a volumetric mixer. And a volumetric mixer basically keeps all of the materials, the cement, the aggregates and the water separate until they get out to the job site, and then through a very complicated augering system out the back end, just like a transit mixer, out comes concrete. Under the Oregon law currently right now, these are treated different in as far as their taxation, and so that's what we're going to try to solve right now. They pay both weight mile taxes, and they pay property tax, which is a double tax when the transit mixers are paying just the road use tax. So what we're going to do is we're going to clean up some changes. One of the things I think is very interesting is, and I don't know why this is the case, but folks still mix up the difference between concrete and cement, and we're going to try to clarify that, and we're going to clean it up in the statute. The other thing we're going to do is move volumetric mixers under the same category as transit mixers. So this is a tutorial. Cement is an ingredient of concrete. Concrete has about 6% air in it, 11% Portland cement, 41% gravel and crushed stone. Of course, most of you know I spend a lot of time on the gravel side. 26% sand and 16% water. And when you mix all of that together, you get concrete. So the problem with the statute is that it refers to things like cement batch plants and cement mixers. There isn't such a thing. It's you got to use the word concrete. So we're going to clean that up. So, and that's what I say. Treat concrete delivery trucks similar under Oregon law and taxation rules. We're going to create competitive fairness across types of concrete delivery trucks. So the littlest guys are on the same tax system as the big guys. I think that's a fair approach that promotes small business. And we're going to fix some stuff that just, you know, I mean, eliminate cement mixers and cement batch plants, cement paving finishers. Replace cement with concrete, because those things actually do not exist. So that's the goal. Here's a transit mixer, and it's a drum. The way it works is it's gets all the material at the batch plant put together, and it's poured into that particular drum, and that drum has to turn. It can't turn too much, because if it turns too much out to the job site, the materials actually start to separate in the truck, right? And the other thing you can't do is you can't stop it from turning, right? Because it's going to seize up. But what comes out the back end is what we all use and every day is concrete. And one thing I would say on this, batching is a continuing process. It really does start at the fixed batch plant. But we add mixtures and things like that into the concrete truck. Batching actually continues all the way through the process, even for these. It's a little different until it comes out the back end. Then you get the desired product. We actually put a lot of admixtures and things in the cement now. We put super plasticizers and retardants that and accelerators and all kinds of things to get strengths and things for our roads and bridges. So the volumetric mixer, again, the point I'm trying to make here is exact same material comes out the back end of the truck. And that's important, because in the test in the statute, if the primary purpose is to deliver equipment to the job site, it's a personal, it's taxed under property tax, right, as a property tax. If the primary purpose is to deliver a material, then it's not taxed as it's not taxed the same way. And that's what we're trying to show here, is this is a delivery of a material. We're not actually taking equipment out as a primary purpose. We think the controversy probably started with the word mobile mix, and we thought, because one of our companies used the word mobile mix and the statute refers to mix mobile, it created that situation, and we thought that was an interpretation that at least it was accurate from the folks that were looking at it, but it created this disparity that needed to be fixed. So I just wanted to point out, you know, how we kind of got there as far as our little bit of a problem statement. These are the things that are taxed as property tax. This is a concrete batch plant that's a semi-permanent unit. And it can be taken down and transported to any job site, right? But the primary purpose when you're moving this is to move that equipment out that then will batch the material. So it's taxed not – it may pay a oversized road fee through motor carrier, but it's taxed under personal property tax for the company. I think I said that right. Mark, is that right? Personal property tax? Okay. And, of course, then you have the normal batch plant, concrete batch plant. This is also taxed the same way. Right, so I'm just making a clarification on what's going on here. Okay, again, the point, both deliver concrete. Now, so these folks do compete with the big guys. Here we have a volumetric mixer doing a deck repair for the Portland Airport. Here we have another volumetric mixer doing the 82nd overpass on 84. You know, here we have the Nakanakum Bridge deck out on Highway 26. And what's interesting is, by keeping the material separate for these volumetric mixers, is they're able to go farther than the normal transit mixer, because they're not mixing the material. Concrete's a perishable product. You can't keep it in the, and we say, and you've heard me say this before, that our range is kind of 30 miles around the batch plant. Maybe we can get out 45, we can slow it down and put a bunch of material in it, admixtures that actually slow down the curing process. So Nakanakum, you know, that's quite a ways from any kind of facility, so we can get out to it. And, so it's a unique kind of truck delivery system, allows us to extend the reach of the material. Here we have Interstate 5 overpass at Woodburn that was poured by a volumetric mixer. Now here's a transit mixer, and a little different one. This is a Knife River one, and this is this particular one is a it's just a configuration of a transit mixer. And looking at that, I thought when I grabbed that picture, we grabbed one of the front end loading ones. Yeah. So if you look at that picture towards where the concrete's actually coming out, the cab and the truck driver actually is right there. Instead of the concrete coming out of the back, this particular configuration drops the concrete out of the front. And that just kind of educates you there's several different configurations. All of them will, if this bill passes, be treated exactly the same way under the fixed load statutes and under our taxation system. But here's the roundabout, in one of the roundabouts, I think, in Bend. And that's just another version of it, and another unique kind of delivery system. These are very flexible concrete trucks. They're pretty cool. So I think I'm about done. Again, we're trying to clean up the statute because there's errors in the statute as it exists. We're trying to treat trucks the same, and we're trying to create competitive fairness and equalize the playing field. So with that, that's my presentation, folks. I kind of wove in what we did with some education at the same time. Vice Chair Vile, thank you for the opportunity.
Any questions of Mr. Angstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rich, is it true then that cement is always going to be an additive? It's never going to be a standalone product?
Vice Chair Vile and Representative Wilson, when it's used for construction purposes, that's right. You know, cement really is lime and gypsum mix, right? And we use it for, it gets used for all kinds of things like soil amendments and things like that. So it can actually be used for non-construction purposes to change the alkalinity of soils. Yeah. But when it's used in construction, it's always combined with others in other material and made into concrete or a product called consolidated base, treated base, controlled density fill, and one of these guys can explain that product. But for the most part, yeah, it's always mixed with something else.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
So there's no such thing as cement shoes, actually.
No, it's concrete shoes.
Concrete. Thank you.
Representative McClain.
Thank you. It makes a lot of sense. Everything that you gave was very, very clear. The two words that come to mind as I'm listening to this, just because others will ask me, what's the difference, you know, as far as capacity? You talked about capacity away from the batch plant, but capacity of the larger trucks versus the capacity of the smaller trucks, plus the weight of the larger trucks versus the weight of the smaller trucks. Because, I mean, you're taking two different tax systems and you're, you know, so I just...
Yeah, so Vice Chair Vile and Representative McClain, on a couple of those points, I think you better ask Rick Nations, who's going to come up, because he's really kind of the lead on that kind of thing. But concrete trucks, there are six-yard concrete trucks, and I think we max out at 10-yard concrete trucks because we have to stay within weight bounds set by the motor carrier, so we can only put so much weight on those vehicles. So those are the range, and those are all treated under motor carrier paying weight mile tax. And on the other question on what the weight of these things are in comparison, I would ask Rick Nations on that one.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Chair Vile. Question related to if this is going to change the taxation system. Have we heard from LRO about any impact, because we're already dealing with budget issues, you know? And what kind of...
Yeah, excellent. Vice Chair Vile and Vice Chair Meek, I've talked to just about every interest group that's on this. Revenue is probably the appropriate group to talk to if there's going to be a revenue impact. And I'm going to put words in Mark Garst, and he's here in the room today. But what I understand is that there will be no revenue impact because it actually has been limited application of this. This cleans it up beforehand. I think that answers the question. And I think they're neutral on the bill. And if I don't think he was planning on testifying, but with the question, he might want to come up and at least give revenue's thoughts on it.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to make sure we're not going to have any issues getting this passed, because sounds great.
That would be
a great
idea.
Yeah.
Representative Meek, do you want to get that question answered now? We could certainly have that.
Oh, sure, if he's here. Yes, thank you.
you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Vice Chair Vial, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I work for the property tax section at the Department of Revenue. So we anticipate that there will be some limited revenue impact. It'll be to the local jurisdictions, not to the general fund. Property taxes, as a rule, go to the locals. And so in as much as this will allow these folks not to pay double taxes, as it was characterized, whatever property taxes that they won't be paying will, you know, come will be coming out of the budgets of those local districts. So,
all right, thank you very much. We're running a little. Yeah, Representative Evans.
Vice Chair, I'll just real quick, if I could, a question for Rich that I hope I know the answer to. As I understand, very limited use of this taxation right now. That's why we're trying to make sure that it kind of headed off at the pass. The county that has been identified as using it is currently neutral on this. Is that correct?
Yeah. Vice Chair Vial and Representative Evans, it's only been applied one time in one county on one company.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your time. We have four members of the industry here, Dean Meyer, Rick Nation, Brian Holland, and Dwight Miller. Why don't all four of you come on up? Pull up one more of those chairs if you'd like, and you can identify yourself for the record before you start to speak, and I'll let you figure out who wants to talk first and in what order. We are running slightly short on time, so we apologize in advance if we need to kind of move things along.
Who's up, fellas?
Go for it.
Thanks. Chair, for the opportunity to give some testimony today. The four of us are friendly competitors.
Identify yourself
I'm
first,
sorry,
if you don't mind.
thank you. I'm Brian Holland, and with, Oregon On-Site Concrete, and we are located in Wilsonville, Sherwood area, and we service the Portland metro area.
And my district, by the way, just so everyone knows.
And we presently have five trucks, volumetric trucks, and with some favorable treatment of this bill, we will anticipate taking some additional revenues that might otherwise go to taxes and reinvest in some additional equipment and some additional employees. So we are a very small family-owned business, 6.5 employees, and the half employee. Well, I consider myself one of the six. My wife works as in a part-time capacity. So this is very much a small business, and with our competitors here, we are all small businesses. And we compete, we attempt to compete with the big boys that you see rolling down the road. And with maybe some anticipated infrastructure funds becoming available, we're looking forward to increasing our capital, probably all of us, I certainly am, and supporting what I hope is some infrastructure opportunities.
Members of the committee, why don't we hold questions until we hear from all four of them, if that's okay? All right, who's next?
My name is Rick Nation. I own Nation's Mini Mix Concrete in Eugene, Oregon. Been in business since 1994. It's definitely a family-run business. Got both of my kids, wife, and myself work the company. I would like to see this bill looked at to be, like Brian said, to be more competitive with the bigger guys. I know you had a question too on the weights and sizes of trucks and stuff like that. I'd be happy to answer that when the time comes.
All righty. Thank you, Rick.
My name is Dwight Miller, and I have Miller's Mini Mix Concrete. Been in business for 16 years. I have four volumetric trucks, three full-time employees, one part-time. Pretty much have always been a mom-pop operation till about 2 years ago. We become a bama and a papa operation, so really like that. But our work deliveries range from, we've made deliveries under the U.S. Bank Tower, for small pour back repairs to the city of Beaverton, all the different cities around, and to homeowners, small contractors, homeowners that haven't a clue what they're doing. So we service that wide range. And I would just like to see this bill passed to help us out.
Thank you very much. And if you want to just kind of scoot that towards you just a little bit, there you go.
Dean Meyer, work for Short Load Concrete, Wilsonville, Sherwood area. I'm a manager there. We have 6 trucks, 4 employees at this time because it's wintertime. One of the things Representative Evans said was the green effect of our trucks, since they have the term volumetric, meaning it's rock, sand, cement, water in separate components. We have the ability to stop mixing, producing concrete on the job site when the project is full. So if they overorder, we have no waste to go back, which saves on the amount of rock and sand, cement mixed with water, saves a lot of the carbon dioxide gases that are emitted from all industry.
These guys have really changed my farm operation, because now I can't get a short load anymore to do that little piece of the barn that I used to do.
You can call any one of us, or all three in your area. But they say for, it's pound for pound. When you talk the cement only, to produce that, it's a pound of carbon dioxide for a pound of cement. And if we can stop, save some of that that does not need to be mixed, then you're helping the environment.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much. And
answer the question on the trucks.
Yeah. Why don't you go ahead and ask the question again, Susan?
Would you just be able to tell me just approximately how much these trucks weigh?
Most of your trucks are either 6, 8, or 10-yard capacity. The Federal Bridge in Oregon, 8-yard capacity is what most people run. Okay. And you're in the 60,000-pound range.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for a moment, I want to thank you guys for being here today. As a fellow small business owner to other small business owners, nobody knows the risks we take just staying in business like you guys do. And so thank you for all you do, for the jobs that you provide. This legislative body, as you well know, makes all kinds of decisions as it relates to small and medium-sized business. Many of those things we do can tend to be extremely punitive, and I'm sorry for that. But when we deliberate small business issues in this body, I hope we will remember those 4 faces there as representative of small business and what makes this country great. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson, and I'll echo that. Any other questions or comments before we let these gentlemen go? Yes.
One of the things is, as small businesses, I think every one of us has to buy our aggregates from a source that is our direct competitor. We could say, like, that one instance up there was a Knife River truck. We buy our rock and sand from Knife River. Knife River sells concrete. So when in essence, we buy from them, and then we have to compete back with them. So even
stuff. And that's the point of clarification, is we're competing with them, and they have a distinct tax advantage. And while we would like to share in taking that revenue out, all of us, it's not a matter of shoving it in our pockets. It goes right back into our businesses. At least that's what I do.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate you taking the time to come today.
Thank you very much.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2022. We're holding the public hearing on House Bill 2289. Hold that over, and we'll go to an informational meeting with the Oregon Travel Information Council. Craig Campbell. Thank you for your patience. We really appreciate it. And we'll just make sure that you remember to identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Travel Information Council and would like to beg your indulgence for allowing me to have two folks join me today. I learned a long time ago, if you're going to be presenting, make sure you have somebody who can vary what you're saying so that you're not boring, and somebody who knows all the details in case you get into trouble and can refer to them. Joining me today is Nancy D'Souza. She's the Executive Director of the Travel Information Council on my right. And on my left is Tim Pickett, and he is the operations manager for the Travel Information Council. Before I get into our discussion today about rest areas, I wanted to give you very brief background that the Travel Information Council also is responsible for the gas, food, and lodging signs that you see along the roads. Those are the blue signs that let you know when you can pull over and get gas at the next stop, that sort of thing. We're also responsible for heritage markers throughout the state and for historical tree markers as well. To start with, I'm going to give you a very brief background about how we ended up having rest areas. It's not a very long history. Back in 2006, Governor Kulongoski created a transportation and tourism task force. And among the things that they looked at the condition of rest areas and the way the public perceived them. What they found out is that, by and large, those who were visiting the state and those who traveled in the state that used them were concerned about entering them after dark because of concerns about crime. They were concerned about the cleanliness and the repair level of those rest areas. And a lot of that comes from the fact that it's fairly old infrastructure and that those that have been charged to operate them have a really tremendous responsibility in other areas where they focus their attention. So as a result of that work, the legislature in 2009, when they passed the Jobs and Transportation Act, decided that they were going to come up with a new idea to transfer a certain number of rest areas over to us, the Travel Information Council, and have us do things differently with a more robust process that required us to manage, maintain, improve, and develop those rest areas in a way that they would like to have them done. The legislature did that initially with seven rest areas, and they added through an interagency agreement with ODOT and us two additional ones at that point in time. And then back in 2012, they added another 12 locations so that we currently manage 29 rest areas in seven locations, which is essentially the I-5, I-84 corridor, and plus we have two other additional rest areas, Government Camp and the Tillamook rest area, that we manage as well. Now, under our model, our responsibility is to make sure that those rest areas are safe, convenient, and comfortable, and of course, free to stop. That's important. We manage the restroom facilities. We make sure that folks have a place to just pull over so that they can take a nap, get out, stretch themselves when they're traveling long distances. If they have pets, make sure those pets can get out and exercise as well. If they need to use a cell phone, of course, we would much prefer them to pull off, and providing rest areas at certain distances so that they can do that conveniently as part of what we provide as well. And of course, as you're driving down the road, if you don't know where you're going, sometimes it's nice to have a place to pull off and figure out where you're going to go next. And the nice thing is we have people on site that allow you to do that and help you do it. We also provide truck and auto parking for those who need to have a longer period of time. They can stay up to 12 hours. And it's critically important for the trucking industry to have that available to them, especially when they're dealing with their hour limitations in transportation. We also have available kiosks that provide information about the area around us. One of the goals that the legislature charged us with is making sure that we are working with our partners to try and provide information about what opportunities there are nearby to help the economies and local businesses and activities in the cities near where our rest stops are. Now, our model is to staff these rest areas 8 hours a day, 365 days a week, and that is more expensive, to be sure. But it was specifically designed and charged by the legislature to make sure that those rest areas are, in fact, safe, clean, in good repair, and most importantly, welcoming, because rest areas are often the first place that people who are visiting our state see. And so we want to make sure it provides a nice, welcoming opportunity for them. Now, our rest areas are currently funded out of the highway fund, which is where the legislature directed. Now, all the rest areas we currently have been transferred to us from ODOT, who is responsible for several other rest areas, as are the parks. But these are paid out of the highway fund. There's certain restrictions as to what we can do with those funds, and I can get into detail if you would like me to about those restrictions. We make sure that our staff are capable of handling issues that allow them to interface effectively with OSP, because they are very close partners in a lot of the things that go that happen in the rest area that we would rather not, because part of our charge is to limit the opportunity for crime, and having our folks on staff there as much as we do helps that quite a bit. I am going to turn it over now to Nancy D'Souza to talk a little bit about how we work with our key partners and how valuable that they are.
Before she starts.
Hold on just a minute. You have
Mr.
a question?
Chair, I just think maybe somebody can answer this. You mentioned one item that we've heard around the state when we have been on the Joint Transportation Committee, and that is there enough room for truckers to pull off safely and sleep those 12 hours? And so if you have any information, any of you, to deal with capacity for truckers in those facilities, I'd sure appreciate it. Or you could get back to me.
Chair Vile, Representative McClain, I know that there are others who will have much better information. However, one of the things we're going to talk to about is the importance of us maintaining our parking areas, because you're right, there isn't enough area for, especially as trucking mileage is growing rather substantially. And so providing places for those folks to comply with their hourly limitations and have a place to safely park where they don't interrupt transportation, but also it's safe for those truckers to rest. We provide a critical element there. However, our rest areas are limited as to exactly how much space they have unless we acquire additional space and grow those parking areas. So we don't really contribute much to expanding the availability of space, but what we do provide is critically important to the trucking industry.
Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Nancy D'Souza, Executive Director of the Travel Information Council, and we do business as Oregon Travel Experience. You'll hear us called both names, but in statute we are the Travel Information Council, and when we call ourselves Oregon Travel Experience, we often get confused with Travel Oregon, which we are not. We are the infrastructure agency that handles the mechanics of, as Craig said, the Blue Highway logo signs and the heritage programs that we operate, and then the operation of the rest areas. And we do that with some key partners. Principal, and it's not really a partner, it's the entity that governs the agency and I report to, is the Travel Information Council itself. And it's appointed by the governor, 8 members appointed by the governor, and 1 member who is a representative of the Transportation Commission. We have our chair, Gwen Baldwin, and vice chair, Bob Russell, in the back of the room, and they're well known to all of you, I believe. And we work real closely together to make sure our relationships with our partner organizations and their governing bodies are strong and solid. And so our key partners include ODOT and the Transportation Commission. ODOT, as Craig said, does own the rest areas, and we are restricted in our use of highway funds, and they are very careful stewards of how we spend those dollars. Tim Pickett, our operations director, handles our finances and also our annual financial review that is contracted through the Secretary of State that shows that we are spending those dollars appropriately in all cases. We also are close partners with Travel Oregon and the Oregon Tourism Commission, and then underneath that, the destination marketing organizations that represent regions and localities around the state, because one of our charges is to provide that information to travelers, but we don't provide the content ourselves. Again, we are the infrastructure through our kiosks, and we want to be the mechanism by which they can get information to the people who are visiting our rest areas around the state. And then a third primary partner is Oregon State Police. We work very closely with them to help keep our rest areas safe. And over the past year, they have been really incredible partners. And Lieutenant Steve Duvall of the Statewide Patrol Division has brought out training to all of his troopers statewide that we developed together to allow them to go into rest areas, whether we are calling because we see criminal activity or because they see it themselves, and it's an exclusion program that gives them an additional tool that even if someone is not convicted of a crime, but the officer or trooper has significant evidence that there is criminal activity, can tell them they may not return to that one rest area for a period of between 30 days and a year, and they do have due right processes, but it's been a tremendous tool to keep drug use, prostitution, and other bad things out of our rest areas, and we're really proud of those partnerships. You can see some pictures up here of some of our rest areas around the state, and when the agency took on these rest areas, we understood there were going to be day-to-day challenges. By design, the Travel Information Council is able to focus on those challenges, both the anticipated and unanticipated ones at a level that our partners at ODOT weren't able to do because of the tremendous scope of their duties. We're more focused, and so we can look and see the details, the things that people are going to notice. It's just like when you're living in a house, you don't notice the deferred maintenance, but when you go to sell it, somebody else sure does. Well, that's what we try to do every day with boots on the ground. We have staff in each rest area 8 hours a day, 365 days a year, and emergency and on-call people who can come in after hours. And so we're able to prioritize and improve both on individual locations and system-wide improvements. So we've been addressing deferred maintenance, facility upgrades, and ways to improve travelers' overall experiences. And a good example is what we did at Government Camp. We took this over several years ago, and this is one that was originally slated to be closed, but it does receive over 500,000 visitors a year, and it's on the highway going up to the mountain. And so structurally the building was sound, but just doing the cleanup, sprucing up, upgrading the heating system, and trying to make things nicer for the people coming in. We've also gone into partnership, and you'll see in the picture on the far right, this is an electronic kiosk that provides that travel information we were talking about that we're doing in cooperation with Clackamas County Tourism, where they're working with us to provide the content and we provide the infrastructure. So we also get some of the unpleasant elements besides the normal cleanup of, if you've ever cleaned up after teenagers in a bathroom, imagine, you know, 18 million of them through your system each year. There's a lot that our staff are expected to do, but they also face, you know, the unexpected that has become normal, where we have a tremendous amount of graffiti, drug paraphernalia, vandalism, find weapons in the rest area where people have left them behind. One of those is a box of marijuana, stems and seeds, I believe, and mostly leaves, but it's still there and needs to be taken care of. A pile of butane where people had been doing methamphetamine production in an RV in the rest areas and then dumped that. And so we are able then to find these things, call state police, get them involved, and it's really working to help make our rest areas much, much safer. We have toll-free numbers posted in each rest area, as I said, so our after-hours response time is generally 1 hour for emergencies. If it's not calling for law enforcement patrol to come in, our staff are required to be on call on a rotating basis and be there on time. And then just for fun, we've had a little bit this winter with snow in our rest areas, and we've gone for several years since I took over as executive director of this agency without many snow events. This year we've had many, and so our staff have done yeoman's work in keeping our rest areas open, because when ODOT closes a freeway, not everybody can get off of it right away, and they often end up stranded in our rest areas with staff who are there and stay and work the extra hours to take care of them, make sure they're safe, call for tow trucks, dig them out, do the things that are necessary to keep them running. So it's going to be a nice spring. We're looking forward to that. Craig?
And again, Craig Campbell for the record. However, as much as those were anticipated things that we were going to have to deal with when we originally were given this charge, there are things that have not been anticipated that have dropped into our lap that we've discovered as we've done this work. The first is, of course, dealing with some deferred maintenance. As I had mentioned, some of this is very old infrastructure. And when you're dealing with water systems, sewer system, electric systems, et cetera, those things eventually need to be replaced and upgraded when you discover the problem that you have. And I have the benefit, being the lobbyist for the organization, to have heard some of the stories about what happens when a sewer system fails. As legislators, you're fortunate in that I don't have to convey those stories to you. But they do happen. And they are rather costly, because it means, in some cases, replacing or doing rather substantial improvements to those older systems. Those systems, by the way, are connected to existing water and sewer districts that expect us to do our part in maintaining those parts of the system. We also have large-scale maintenance issues, in particular, critical parking for cars and trucks. Those of you who have been involved with the Joint Transportation Committee or have experience with highway construction know that if you allow a paving surface to deteriorate to a certain point, it becomes much, much more expensive as the substrata starts to deteriorate. our goal is to try and make sure that doesn't happen. But overlays with the amount that we're dealing with are very, very expensive propositions and take up a large chunk of the revenues that we have to set aside. And this is something that's important here. We didn't know that these costs were going to come along. So what we ended up having to do is we ended up having to curve and cut back and be very, very careful about how we spent our money so that we could set aside money in anticipation of having to resolve them. So in addition to these, the parking structures, we also recently, ODOT was part of an ADA lawsuit. Because we're part of the transportation system, the findings of that ADA lawsuit as far as it relates to requiring ADA upgrades apply to us as well. We don't yet know exactly what the extent of those costs are going to be, but they are going to be substantial. And we have to take that, take care of those issues out of the revenues that we have, which were essentially for the traditional maintenance preservation and service provision. Finally, our capacity, when it was designed for a population in Oregon that no longer exists. Our growth has gone rather substantially. And we have a picture up here of Oak Grove. One of the areas that is of some concern is if you've ever been to a sports event, you will often notice that at least on the female side of the rest areas, that there tends to be a long line. Oak Grove happens to be the place where people, as they're going to duck football games and coming from duck football games, tend to go. And this is what beavers. Ends up happening, and beavers too, although some of them can just go straight from Eugene the other way. But what's important here is that this infrastructure was not designed to handle this level, and sometimes when there's a long line, people find alternative ways of relieving that particular need that don't involve going into the restroom. So part of what we need to do here is that we do need to replace this particular facility. We're going to show you a slide about what we're going to be doing with that as well. Plus, we have seismic and roofing issues in this particular rest area, and we'll have in others as well. But again, we're not funded for doing that, so we have to do it by holding back what we have.
Mr. Campbell, I think Representative Evans had a question.
Thank you, Vice Chair Vile. My question is a little open-ended, but it is related to what you just said about capacity. However, still not sure why anybody would want to go to a duck game, but if they did, I understand your point. The question has to do with, as you are looking to expand some of these places, especially with the trucking need and tourism need, would it be possible to identify areas where expansion would be easier than not? And the reason for that is some of these areas seem to coincide with where we would want to have response capacities for resilience. And theoretically, there could be some funds available to upgrade the systems and structures that we could use on a daily basis, but are there when there is, in fact, an emergency requirement. So to the extent that you know of the areas you'd like to expand, that they kind of overlap with the areas that we need extra space and capacity, I encourage you to perhaps maybe look at it from that perspective as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Evans, and in particular instance, talking about where some of these areas might serve as staging areas for responding to, say, large-scale seismic events. Yes, we've been talking about that and trying to figure out whether or not there are opportunities for growth. Where these areas are surrounded by private lands, there's also hasn't really been a robust discussion about whether or not there are revenues available for that, but we're cognizant of the fact that if we do act as a staging area, some of our rest areas are better suited for that than others. And so as we have the discussion in particular with the military department about whether or not that
follow up, if I could. The Emergency Preparedness Committee has a work group working on that specific task that's bringing ODOT and other sources. Your perspective on the impact to both tourism as well as the daily traffic flow could be critical because we are setting up bonding guidelines at this point for some of the things that are moving forward, and that would be very helpful.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Evans, first of all, thank you for raising that issue for us. The other thing I should say is since we don't own the rest areas, it's really ultimately ODOT's responsibility to make those decisions.
But you have a better eye on who's going through
discussions.
Them.
Yes, thank you.
Craig, I apologize, but we're going to have to close here pretty quick. If you could take just another minute or two and prioritize any further comments that you have.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We do need to look at our long-term needs, and that basically means that stabilizing our funding for what we are doing, as you see this cost curve, our funding level and what our actual costs are is going to change to the point where we're operating in the red instead of the black, starting right around 2018-2019. We want to make sure that that revenue discussion happens in conjunction with the transportation funding package, because we don't want to do anything that takes away revenue from ODOT's existing obligations. So we really are looking for some form of new revenue to take care of that. We are dealing with the need for addressing inflationary factors. That amount we get right now, as you notice, is flat. It doesn't take into account increased costs associated with construction costs, labor costs, PERS, all of those sort of things that affect every state agency, and we're a semi-independent state agency. We have the same problems. And then finally, having some ability to have capital maintenance and construction funds, so that when we do have major projects, we have some way of taking care of those without siphoning off from the service we provide to the public and then waiting for a long time before we have enough pool for us to make those larger investments.
Representative Barreto.
Yeah, can I ask one question on that last chart on the cost there? So if your operating cost right now is below what you're being funded, are you saving these the dollars for further?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, that's exactly why that dollar number is there. It's because we have kind of imposed restrictions upon ourselves so that we can set money aside for taking care of the larger scale costs.
May I briefly? Mr. Vice Chair and Representative Barreto, we have been, through Tim's careful stewardship, creating some of these reserve funds, and you'll see in the materials that we have submitted a list of some of the projects we've already carved out funding for, and we have funding carved out for some things like replacing one side of the Oak Grove rest area. We hope in this year those ADA upgrades and some key sewer and paving projects. What you see where the red line is going up is where we are actually spending down those reserves, and so we hit a critical point in 2021 where we no longer are able to carve out any money, and every dollar we get from that $6.55 million has to go for the services, and we see a declining ability to pay for any type of improvement other than basic maintenance.
Representative McLean.
And I'm assuming that you are attending the meetings tonight. Are you going to Mr. Bence's work group?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will be going back and forth between Representative Bence's and Representative Boquist's committee, so hopefully we'll be able to get that. Okay.
Sounds good.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, Craig, could we talk some time about the panhandling policy in these rest areas? Just,
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson, I am at your convenience.
Thank you.
And I apologize, Mr. Pickett, we didn't give you an opportunity to visit with us, but perhaps we can have you folks back at a future date. Thank you very much for taking the time to come and educate us on these important issues.
Thank you very much.
With that, members of the committee, is there any other business that we need to address before we adjourn? Any objection to adjournment? With that, we'll be adjourned.